Exodus chapter 19. On the third new moon, after the Israelites had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. We don't quite know where that is, by the way, because there's not enough evidence to answer that question, but stick with the story. They journeyed from Rephidim. We were told about that a couple of chapters ago. They entered the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. Israel camped there in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God. Yahweh called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the Israelites, you've seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." They couldn't come through the desert on the ground because the Egyptian soldiers would have butchered them. So God, you can see this is an image, I hope, God, like an eagle, went and lifted them up and carried them safely where the Egyptians couldn't get them, and landed them here at Mount Sinai. But it's a lovely image of God's protective care for all of us. Deuteronomy 32 picks up that image too in verse 11. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, as it spreads its wings, takes them up and bears them aloft on its pinions, Yahweh alone guided him. It's quite likely, it's not impossible, we don't want to presume which comes first. Maybe Deuteronomy 32:11 was first, and that the authors of Exodus picked up the image. It could have been the other way, because they're mutually interacting among themselves all the time. Again, a beautiful image of an eagle bearing on their wings the people. Back to Exodus. "Now therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant," berit is the word, Hebrew word for covenant, and it's a little bit tricky too, because there are different levels of covenants in the ancient world. One would be between two equals, the king of here and the king of there would make a covenant. "I'll look after this part of the land, you look after that part of the land. If people attack me, you come to my defense. If they attack you, I'll come to your defense." It's a covenant between equals. But there's another kind of covenant between a suzerain and the vassal king. A little noble that's got this land here. And he's not going to take it over, but he says, "All right, I'll protect you if you give me 10% of your agricultural goods, sheep and that, and if when I call, you will send men to fight in my army. And if you do that, I'll come to your aid if anyone tries to attack you." Pretty good idea, covenant. But the read in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, that is a bit tricky. There's a little bits of element in there, but it's much more like a commitment of God. It's God committing himself to, here it's going to come in a second, to his people. So it's like a one-way promise, really. Now, to keep it, we must keep the commandments and do all that. That's part of the covenant idea. But it's much more like a promise and a commitment from God that's unearned and well beyond desert.
But I'll keep using the word covenant. And this is the commitment that God makes to the people on Mount Sinai. "You shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples." By now I hope you're good at this. If we look at it from God's point of view, we won't see anything, because you can't see from God's point of view. But if you look at it from our point of view, the people saw themselves as God's treasured possession. And what a lovely way to see themselves. What they didn't see was what Jesus saw. That the Samaritans, they were God's treasured possession too, as were the Gentiles. And that's what we picked up, the disciples of Jesus, and that's why we call ourselves Catholic, all-embracing, universal. It's for everyone. Everyone is a treasured possession of God. And that's quite beautiful and should get us beyond xenophobia or nationalism, this crazy thing that we invented somewhere. I'm an Australian, so what? We're a human being, aren't we? So let's get, if we all looked at ourselves as human beings, then the colour of people's skin or their religious ideas, maybe a little bit more wobbly than ours, but maybe not, we would treat each other beautifully. In 2 Corinthians 3:6, Paul says, he has made us to be ministers of a new covenant. A new covenant. And a new covenant, you know what it is, in my blood. It's a new promise. It's a new commitment of God in Jesus that opens a whole lot of stuff up that wasn't open before. 1 Corinthians 11:25, this cup is the new covenant of my blood. The earliest account we've got of the Last Supper, 15 years before Mark's Gospel. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. Do what? One of you, I think it was Beatrice, asked me what this is yesterday. Well, what's the this in this sentence? Do this. Is Jesus saying, I want you to have a ceremony every Saturday night, because that's when they did it, to remember the Last Supper? Yes, that's part of it. But when Jesus says, this cup is a new covenant in my blood, do this. Do what I'm doing. Pour out your life for people, for others. John picks it up. Love one another as I have loved you. That's what the do this is, primarily. And of course, let's celebrate it in a cultic sacrament, of course, as a memorial. But I think Jesus is asking much more of us than that. He's asking us to do what he's doing. John 13:34, I give you a new commandment. Love one another as I have loved you, you should love one another. That's what he wants us to do. The treasured possession is a beautiful word and a lovely image for prayer too. It occurs throughout the Bible. The Greek word, the Hebrew word is segula. Treasured possession. And I can't get by this image I've got, which occurred to me one day a long time ago. As a priest, you see all these things. You're there at the altar, and a mum comes in the side door or the back door late with three little kids. Now, I cannot believe this happens, but I've heard there are priests who would rouse on her for being late. Well, I'm sorry, but if I were the bishop, I would sack him on the spot. Gone. I mean, we can sack people for other reasons. This is worse than any of the others, probably. For God's sake, what's going on with him? Doesn't he know what you have to do to get nappies? Doesn't he know how to get three kids? Has he ever tried to get three kids to the church when he lives in the presbytery two feet away? I mean, what on earth is going on? So anyhow, I picture these people. We should be just so grateful they've arrived. And wonderful. And the little two-year-old's got a rag doll dragging it along the floor. Got by the scruff of the neck. And the dog's bitten it, and it's probably been in nappies, and God knows where it's been. And again, the priest should say, don't bring those dirty things into the church. So, dragging along, well, that's a segula in my mind. Like the little two-year-old can't. If mum tried to take it away, the whole church would be in an uproar. So, no one tries to take it away because she's got it, the segula. Well, I don't want to suggest that God has you by the scruff of the neck, but That's the image. Something so precious to God that he can't be God without it. Well, you're a people holy to Yahweh. Yahweh's chosen you out of all the peoples on the earth to be his people. A beautiful way of looking at themselves. What a pity they didn't think it was the same for the Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites and everyone else. That's the pity of it. It's like I'm one of 8 children. Well, if I thought, I actually never thought this, but if I had a thought that I'm my dad's favourite or mum's favourite, there were clear reasons why I couldn't be either of those. But anyhow, had I ever thought that, you'd be stupid, really. I am stupid sometimes, but not that stupid. Everybody's loved. Love is not measured out. And any of you, I know some of you have children. Well, or relatives of them, but you give all your love to the first one, you give all your love to the second, you give all your love to the third one, you give all your love to the seventh one, and you give all your love to the 8th one. What else is love? Well, so, but they saw themselves as God's treasured possession. Beautiful. I wish we all did. Deuteronomy 26:18. Today Yahweh has obtained your agreement. You've agreed to be his treasured people, as he promised you, and to keep his commands. There's a bit of the covenant coming in. Nothing to do with equals, of course, and nothing to do with vassals, really, either. But there is, to actually be the treasured possession, you can't be it unless you live in a certain way. Prophet Malachi, they shall be mine, my special possession. Psalm 135, Yahweh has chosen Jacob for himself and Israel as his own possession. So those beautiful thoughts are there for your reflection. Back to Exodus, verse 6 of 19. Indeed, the whole earth is mine. Obviously. But you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. Profound theology in that too, which we're still drawing on. A priestly kingdom. When the priest on your behalf and with you baptizes a little baby, as you know, boy or girl, the oil of chrism, consecrated by the bishop, previous Holy Week, Easter, consecration, is anointed a priest, a prophet, and a king. So everyone drawn into the Christian community, welcomed into the body of Christ, it's Christ, Jesus' life that is poured into that child, or adult, we'll say child for the moment, poured into that child. So Jesus shares with the child his faith, his hope, his love, his spirit, his communion with God, his priesthood. What is priesthood? It's mediating grace. So that little baby is going to mediate, and of course the baby's already doing it, but in a profound way now through the sacrament, mediating the spirit of Jesus to mum and dad and big brother and sister and the neighbours and the old bachelor who's a crank, but he goes to water when he sees this little baby. And he goes goo, 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 and every other moment of his life he's absolutely impossible to live with. But babies seem to have that effect on us. Bachelor cranks. So that's all happening. So the babies are mediating grace, a special grace now through sacrament. So a wife is a priest to her husband. A husband is a priest to his wife. A parent is a priest to the child. A teacher is a priest. We're baptized. We're sharing in Jesus' priesthood. With the ordained priest, that's another way of doing it, is the priest for the assembled community. So that's, they're all special, but that's socially, especially significant to the society, to the grouping, to the assembly. Well, you know all that, but it's important to remember it. Because I find when I do baptisms, most parents don't think of themselves as priests. They don't realise what they're doing when they love. But it's a priestly kingdom. When I was ordained, 53 and a half years ago, we walked down the aisle and everybody sang, "Tuer sacer docile eternum." I can sing a bit still, some kind of a noise coming out of there. secundum ordinem Melchizedek. And the organ belted out, and the woman playing the organ was so proud of herself, she'd been practicing all the year. And I've done over 50 clergy retreats in my tender priestly ministry, and I asked them, what does that mean? They haven't got a clue. Secundum ordinem Melchizedek. Everyone's read the story of Melchizedek in Genesis chapter 19, I think it is. But actually, secundum ordinem Melchizedek, I didn't know what it meant. We say it with gusto, but what's it got to do with this bloke in Salem in chapter 19 of the thing who appears for about five verses and then vanishes? Well, the priesthood that Jesus had was not the priesthood of the Levitic line, because he wasn't a Levite. He was a Judahite. He belonged to another tribe. He couldn't be a priest. He was a layman in the Jewish world, but he was a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was the kingly priest. And in Psalm, whatever it is, they sing too. That's where it comes from, the psalm. The king, when he was consecrated king, that's the king of Judah, he wasn't a Levite. He didn't go into the sanctuary and perform all the ceremonies. His job was to make the whole land holy. The kingly reign of God, bring about the reign of God in the world. That was his role. And the role of the ordained priest, deacon, priest now, he's responsible for the community, the body of Christ. And my mother wasn't. She was responsible for Dad and us and the Legion of Mary, and it went on and on and on and on and on. But it wasn't her grace to get up in church and be the priest to the assembly. You know what I'm saying, don't you? But she had a beautiful grace. And we're not saying which is more important or less important. I mean, Mary's priesthood, a hell of a lot better than anyone I've ever had. I mean, because she's mediating grace everywhere. And anyhow. So it's the kingdom, the king, and also we're all called to be prophets. That is, to be mediators of the word, to what Paul says, do the truth in love. That's what prophecy means. So, but the grounds of it are here, and that's Peter picks this up well. Here's Isaiah 61:6. First, you should be called priests of Yahweh. You, the whole people, you shall be named ministers to our God. Here's Peter writing to the people of Pontus, that's northern Turkey, in the Black Sea. Like living stones, he says to everybody, let yourselves be built into a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. You are a chosen race, a holy, a royal priesthood, that's the secundum ordinem Melchizedek, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvellous light. Good old Peter, that's what he's saying to the communities. The book of Revelation has three, I'll give you one. Jesus Christ made us, all of us, into a kingdom, priests serving his God and Father. I think one of the most rich catechetical things to do, which was never done when I was a young person, nor was it ever done in the seminary I went to, was when we studied the priesthood, there was a little called a scholion, a footnote about that long, talking about the priesthood of the faithful. And there were chapters and chapters about the priesthood of the ordained. Well, we've improved our game since then. And I think one of the things we can help people, if they only realised how sacred their lives were, how priestly, I think they'd be more conscious of the sacrament that they've experienced in baptism. Back to Exodus. It's a pretty rich chapter, this one. I hope you're enjoying it. I'm getting a great kick out of giving it. Exodus 19:7. So Moses came, summoned the elders of the people, elders. The Greek is presbyteroi, priests, presbyters. And he set before them all these words that Yahweh had commanded him. And the people all answered as one, "Everything that Yahweh has spoken, we will do." For the rest of Exodus, most of Numbers, and all the prophets are going to be telling the people, well, you're not doing it. You know what I mean? You're doing it, but very badly. So there's a whole lot of stuff saying, look, we undertook to do this, we've got to do it. So Moses reported the words of the people to Yahweh, because obviously Yahweh didn't know about it till Moses told him. It's an image, but you can live with that, can't you? Now, another critical point. Exodus 19, still 9. Yahweh said to Moses, "I'm going to come to you in a dense cloud, in order that the people may hear when I speak with you and so trust you ever after. Go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and prepare for the third day. Because on the third day, Yahweh will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set limits for the people all around, saying, 'Be careful not to go up the mountain or touch the edge of it. Any who touch the mountain will be put to death.'" This is a sacred place, God's fear, like reverence, awe, wonder. We step back from this. So, Moses went down from the mountain to the people. He consecrated the people. They washed their clothes. He said to the people, prepare for the third day. And on the morning of the third day, so that's the fifth time we've met the expression of the third day in these few verses, there was thunder and lightning as well as a thick cloud on the mountain and a blast of the shofar. So loud that all the people in the camp trembled. On the third day, what's that about? I think this is the sacred text that we've got. This is echoing whenever you see in the New Testament, on the third day, on the third day, on the third day. It's not the second day or the fourth day cut in the middle by the third. It's not a numerical thing. It's a symbolic phrase. I could prove that to you. I've got time, but anyhow, it is. It's symbolic. Now, what's its meaning on the third day? Many books I've read just leave it rather vague. They say it means a reasonable length of time. They've missed it out. When you don't see the dramatic power of the... When you don't read the Bible as a dramatist, you don't get a lot, as it is with every drama. Here's Hosea 6:2. "On the third day he will raise us up, that we may live before him." Does he mean he won't raise us up on the first day or the second day or the fourth day, but he will on the third? Or is he echoing this? Is the third day the day when God reveals God? Come down from the mountain. When you see God, inverted commas, it's the revelation, it's the... Matthew 17:31-23, and it happens throughout the New Testament. Jesus is talking to his disciples. "They'll kill the Son of Man." Some texts use crucify, some just have kill. Some don't talk about that. They just talk about rejection and so on. These are all different developments going on in the Bible, and I haven't got time to do that with you. But this is the point I want to stress with you. "They'll kill the Son of Man, and on the third day he will be raised." Now, some possibilities that we have to be careful of when we're reading Matthew's Gospel. Is the early church looking back? They're remembering Jesus telling them that following him was not going to be easy, it was going to involve suffering, and then when he got to Jerusalem, there's going to be problems. Of course, that was obvious to everybody. Is that what Jesus said to them? And when they look back, and in light of the crucifixion of Jesus on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, third day, is that where they got this phrase? Is that where they have it on the third day? Because it was. We don't know that it was on the third day that he was raised. Actually, we know that on the third day he wasn't there. The tomb was empty. So there's nothing against him being raised on Friday night, or Saturday morning, or Sunday afternoon, or whenever in the meantime. So, but on the is on the third day meaning, is that an act of trust of Jesus? Let's say Jesus used this expression, which is quite likely. They'll kill the Son of Man. They've already, he can see they're out to get him. And Peter, they're going to follow him to Jerusalem. But he's saying to them, look, if you follow me, it's not going to be a garden, a rose garden. On the third day, the Son of Man will be raised. Does that go back to Exodus? I think it does, but I can only say I think it does. In other words, he's saying, God is God and I trust God and God will raise me to himself beyond time in the mystery of God's revelation. When God reveals who God is, I will be raised. He's trusting that even though he loses his life, God will be faithful to him and take him to himself. And on the third day means that in this text. Another place where that occurs is Cana. And you can easily miss this if you read the story and don't get it. Chapter 2, verse 1. So all we've had is the prologue, beautiful prologue, and then the gathering of the disciples and an early catechesis of who Jesus is in that chapter 1. That's all there. The gospel starts chapter 2. First scene of the public ministry, Cana. Second scene, emptying of the temple. They're both in chapter 2. John chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 and 12 are all about you and me having to choose between them. You can't have it both ways. If your religion is primarily focused on the temple, temple's beautiful, but it's done its job. If your focus is on the scaffolding, well, when the building's been complete, why don't you come inside and have a cup of tea? What are you looking at the scaffolding for? It's arrived. So that's that. On the third day means the day of God's revelation. So John is going to see Jesus begin to reveal himself to them on this occasion. And anyone familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, and they were, they didn't have many books in their life, but that was one they definitely had, soon as they saw or heard on the third day, their mind flashed back to Mount Sinai. Continue. Exodus, still 19, chapter 19. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. They took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because Yahweh had descended upon it in fire. These are all symbol images. The smoke went up like the smoke of a kiln while the whole mountain shook violently. As the blast of the horn, the shofar, grew louder and louder, Moses would speak and God would answer him in thunder. Then Yahweh descended upon Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. Yahweh summoned Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Matthew 5, 1-5, Jesus went up the mountain. His disciples came to him and he taught them. This is Mount Sinai. Well, Jesus didn't climb Mount Sinai, but that's the It's a Mount of Beatitudes, but it's a mountain. And when you hear, when Jesus goes up on the mountain, the image is Moses going up on the mountain. Matthew 14:23. After Jesus had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. This is the ascended Christ. This is Jesus who's no longer with her, with the community of Matthew's writing for, because he died. And he's with the Father on the mountain, alone, praying for them. And then you know what follows after that, because we've done it about four times. Matthew 15, Jesus went up on the mountain where he sat down and great crowds came to him. So everyone can come up the mountain now, not just Moses and the rest of us fearful at the sides. We're all welcomed up on the mountain where God is going to reveal God's self. Bringing with them the lame and the maimed and the blind and the mute and many others, they put him at his feet and he cured them. The healing of God is happening through Jesus. Matthew 17. That's why we've got the knowledge of the Old Testament helps us reimagine and get the symbolism that's in the new, because that's their language. They're writing with the language of the Old Testament. And that's the advantage of studying it, of course, the main advantage. Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain, again, by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. Something to do with the risen Christ here. His face shone like the sun, his clothes became dazzling white. And suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah. Suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with him I am well pleased." They're the words of the baptism. Listen to him. Listen to him. This will help you. In other words, I'll finish the story first. When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground. They were overcome by fear. But Jesus came up and touched them, saying, "Get up, don't be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw Moses? No. Elijah? No. Jesus alone. The theology behind that account undoubtedly is Moses represents the Torah. Elijah represents the prophets, the Torah and the prophets, the central pieces of the Old Testament revelation. Those two there. No, it's all in Jesus now. So we don't need Moses anymore. We don't need Elijah anymore. We don't need the Torah. We don't need the prophets. Knowing them can help us understand Jesus, of course, but it's all in him. Alone. He is the fulfillment of the Torah and the fulfillment of the prophecies, and everything in the Torah has to be read in the light of its fulfillment, and everything in the prophecies similarly in the light of their fulfillment. And where they don't fit with Jesus, they're wrong, they're partial, they're imperfect. Another Matthew 28, the last scene in Matthew's Gospel. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age." Full stop, curtain, and if you're not careful, you'll invent an ascension. Because Luke talks about the ascension, so you'll put it in there at the end of Matthew and muck up the gospel. We're not denying the ascension. Matthew's point, he ends his gospel saying Jesus is here with us, still with us. Luke wants to say that he's with God. Well, they're both true, but they're saying different things. So when the curtain falls, all you hear, don't imagine the rest of it. Don't have this and Pentecost and all the rest of it. Leave that to Luke. Matthew wants you to hear, I am with you. And remember how Matthew started the gospel? You will be called Emmanuel, God with us. So God with us is Matthew's key insight. Don't lose it. Even at the Last Supper, with you comes back again. So it's, and here at the end, I'm with you always to the end of the age. The curtain falls and we leave the drama confident that the risen Christ is with me, with you, with the church. I'll finish before the hymn with Hebrews 12, 18 to 24. It's Hebrews' letter, it's a great letter. Very beautifully written too, by the way. You have not come, you, this is us, the Christian community, you haven't come to something that can be touched. A blazing fire, darkness, gloom, a tempest, the sound of the shofar, the trumpet, and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that not another word would be spoken to them. Exodus 19. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. It's quite powerful literature, isn't it? And that's what happens whenever we gather for Mass, particularly on the Sunday with the whole community coming together. That's what we're coming to. And the most beautiful picture, symbol, icon, maybe that icon's a better word, of the risen Christ you'll find in Apocalypse chapter 1. Because you can't describe the risen body. Paul couldn't do it, even though he saw Christ. Mary Magdalene couldn't. Nobody can, because it's not describable in our space and time terms. But what the Apocalypse does is it talks about the seven churches, seven little communities, and the risen Christ is present in each of them on the Sabbath, on the Sunday. And he's dressed in priestly, Jewish priestly garments. So you know you're talking about Jesus the priest, present there. And that Jesus the priest is present in the reader when the reader reads the word. Jesus is reading it, but someone has to give the voice. He's present in the choir, even when they're off note. God can look after that. And the organist, even though she's been playing for 700 years, and people think her time might have gone, but she's bashing away on the organ. And the guitarist, who didn't tune up their guitar, but it's all, we're doing our little best, eh? We're here. And in the priest, the ordained priest, gathering the whole people. Well, it's Jesus doing the gathering. It's Jesus saying, this is my body. The priest isn't saying it's my body, because they're not his. Well, it is, but it isn't, you know. It's Christ, and he's part of the body of Christ too. It's Jesus gathering everyone, and that's Hebrews 12:18 says it beautifully, but we have to help ourselves and everyone coming know what's happening when we gather there together. We sinful people, like the people of Corinth, who were pretty sinful. In fact, they were so sinful that Paul said, what you're doing when you come together is not the Lord's Supper. You're going through the rituals, you're going through the processes, but it's not the Lord's Supper, because you've got the rich sitting over there having a feast and they don't give a damn about the poor sitting over here. So you haven't got what it's about. People of the Old Testament saw God as making all things new by taking slaves. He wasn't the king of the powerful or the mountain. He was the king, the ruler, the God of the poor and the lonely and the oppressed. And he took this rabble, these Habiru, into the desert, to the Mount of Sinai, and made a covenant with them, which they accepted. And that became a whole new way of looking at God, which will find its way into, this is me now, not the Bible, will find its way with this Moses group, I'll call them, Levi group. It'll find its way across the Jordan River and become a way of looking at God that captured the imagination of the oppressed, poor, subsistence farmers in the hill country. Because up till then, everyone who thought of God thought of the powerful. Now they thought of God as the one who made them his treasured people. So it's nothing to do with their power. Their power lay in obedience to, listening to, love of, with all their heart, mind, soul and strength, Yahweh. This God who was revealing himself to them, and gradually more and more through the prophets and so on.